KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, we'll have the latest on the Israel-Gaza ceasefire after four Israeli soldiers were released by Hamas and 200 Palestinian prisoners were freed by Israel. And President Trump postponed enforcement of a TikTok ban. Now U.S. investors are in talks to take over the app. Plus, millions of Americans take care of elderly relatives, but the burden of caregiving is often overlooked.
More and more care is coming out of the hospital and into the home, so caregivers are asked to do things that a generation ago only nurses would have done.
It's Sunday, January 26th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump's first week in his second term in office was action-packed, and as NPR's Mara Liasson tells us, he led with his top talking point, immigration.
The immigration orders, for instance, had an immediate effect. The asylum system is shut down for now. People who are at the southern border who had appointments no longer have them. So on that one, politically, Trump chose one of his most popular promises to enact first because the majority of Americans say they agree with Trump, at least in general, that people who are here without legal status should be deported.
Hearing a case brought by four states, a federal judge in Seattle Thursday temporarily blocked Trump's effort to eliminate birthright citizenship for those born in the United States to non-citizen parents. President Trump is telling reporters that Arab nations, including Jordan and Egypt, should increase the number of Palestinian refugees they take in from Gaza. Speaking on Air Force One, Trump said, with Gaza filled with wartime rubble, Arab nations should help build housing in different locations. Israel is preventing Palestinians from entering northern Gaza in a dispute over an Israeli civilian that Israel says should have been released in yesterday's hostages for prisoners swap. Billionaire Elon Musk made a virtual appearance at a political rally for the Nationalist Alternative for Germany party. NPR's Rob Schmitz has details.
Musk addressed a hall of more than 4,000 supporters for the Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD, a far-right party under surveillance by Germany's government for the threat it poses to the country's democracy. Speaking live via video link alongside party leader Alice Weidel, Musk encouraged those gathered to be proud of their German heritage. And he said, quote, "Children should not be guilty of the sins of their parents, let alone their grandparents," referring to Germany's Nazi past. Musk's appearance comes amidst debate over whether a gesture he made twice during an inauguration rally for President Trump was a Nazi-era salute, which he denies. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Florida's legislature is meeting today in a special session. It's been called by Governor Ron DeSantis to take up measures aimed at curbing illegal immigration. NPR's Greg Allen has more from Miami.
President Trump has expressed support for Florida's special session on a series of enforcement measures, including one that would require local officials to help carry out deportations or face suspension. Governor DeSantis wants to make it a state crime to enter the U.S. illegally and to require people to show proof of immigration status before sending money abroad. Republican leaders in Florida's legislature have indicated they may take no action this week, but DeSantis says he'll keep the pressure on.
You can view me as like a dog that's got you on the ankle on immigration. I am not just going to let go.
Lawmakers say they will deal with immigration and other issues in their regular session in March. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is NPR News. President Trump has formally changed the name of the continent's tallest mountain back to Mount McKinley. Former President Obama had renamed the Alaska mountain Denali, the name used for centuries by indigenous people. In an executive order, Trump has renamed the mountain after President William McKinley. If you like pro football, today is your day. Two separate clashes on the field will produce this year's Super Bowl contenders. Greg Eklund has more from Kansas City, where two teams of gladiators will face off.
The Kansas City Chiefs, the two-time Super Bowl champions, square off against the Buffalo Bills, who are trying to reach the Super Bowl for the first time since 1994. Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce says his team will need to be in top form to win.
Everybody understands the stakes and, you know, everything that we got at hand going against these bills. So it's just making sure you're showing that you're going to work more now than ever.
In the NFC Championship, the Philadelphia Eagles are hoping to return to the Super Bowl for the second time in the last 3 years when they host the Washington Commanders. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
In Melbourne, Yannick Sinner of Italy has claimed his second consecutive Australian Open championship. Sinner defeated second-ranked Alexander Zverev of Germany. The 23-year-old tennis champion has become the youngest man to nail two consecutive Grand Slam trophies in Australia in 3 decades. Yesterday, American Madison Keys took the women's title in Melbourne, defeating Aryna Sabalenka. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is now in its second week. It remains precarious, but yesterday, both Israelis and Palestinians had reason to celebrate. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf joins us now from Tel Aviv. Hi, Kat.
Good morning.
So yesterday, 4 Israeli hostages held in Gaza were released. In exchange, Israel released 200 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. What was the scene like?
Yeah, there were scenes of joy on both sides, which is rare these days. Here's what it sounded like in Tel Aviv when it was announced that the soldiers, the 4 women hostages, had made it into the custody of Israeli forces. And here's what it sounded like in Ramallah, in the occupied West Bank, when busloads of Palestinian prisoners and detainees were released there. The 4 Israeli hostages were whisked off to a local hospital for medical checks and to have privacy with their families. And on the Palestinian side of things, about half of those released were sent to the occupied West Bank.
Now this type of exchange, Israeli hostages for Palestinian detainees, happened last weekend, too. But this exchange was different. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so last time it was mostly women who were released and some boys under the age of 18. Many of them had been held without clear charges or were charged with relatively minor crimes. This time there were some Palestinian prisoners released that had been convicted of serious crimes, orchestrating terror attacks on Israel, like suicide bombings and shootings. Many had life sentences. You know, that includes prisoners like Wael Qasim. He was sentenced to 35 life terms. He assisted in the Hebrew University suicide bombing in 2002 that killed 9 people, including 5 Americans. You know, this was part of the agreement to release prisoners like this, but Israel agreed to it only if they were deported. So about 70 prisoners yesterday were sent first to Egypt, and then they'll be sent on to other Arab countries.
Kat, what can you tell us about Palestinians from northern Gaza who were supposed to be able to start returning today? Is that happening?
In short, no, it's been delayed. Israel says that Hamas was supposed to deliver a different hostage yesterday, one of the only civilian women left. So Israel announced that it would delay Palestinians returning to North Gaza until the release of that woman is arranged. Hamas says delaying the return to the north is in violation of the ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, you know, our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, says that thousands of people are gathering in Gaza waiting to go north. He told us that the roads are jammed packed with cars and people. Here's a voice note he sent me from earlier today from one of the main routes north called Salah al-Din.
I'm standing in the middle of Salah al-Din. Thousands of cars are waiting. All of those cars is totally full. We can see trucks. We can see here donkey carts. Every single person took the belongings. They dissemble the tents.
He told me that people are now sleeping in the street, waiting for the green light to return. Many of these people don't know what they're returning to. A lot of the North has been devastated by more than a year of fighting. But Anna says that crowds have just been growing and growing over the past 24 hours as people are eager to end their displacement and find out what's left.
President Trump was talking about Gaza yesterday and said, quote, "You're talking about probably 1.5 million people, and we just clean out that whole thing." He suggested Jordan or Egypt take in Palestinians from Gaza. What have been the reactions to this?
Yeah, Trump said this when talking to reporters traveling with him on Air Force One. This is not U.S. policy right now. He said this in the context of talking about how destroyed Gaza is and that Palestinians should be removed in order to rebuild it. And in answer to a question, he said that it could be a permanent move. Much of the Israeli government has been pretty quiet about this idea this morning. Hamas, on the other hand, strongly rejected it, saying that the whole reason Palestinians endured this war was to stay on their land. You know, there isn't really a plan for what happens after the war in Gaza, and the amount of rebuilding that needs to happen is immense. And right now it is unclear how that will happen.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
There might be a deal to save TikTok. On his first day in office, President Trump signed an executive order instructing his administration to not enforce a ban on TikTok. The order grants a 75-day reprieve from a law that requires TikTok to split off from its Chinese owner or be banned nationwide. Sources close to talks in the White House tell NPR that software company Oracle, Microsoft, and other American investors are working to take over the video app. NPR's Bobby Allen broke the story and joins us now. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Aisha.
TikTok had a wild ride last weekend. It was banned. It wasn't banned. It wasn't clear exactly what President Trump was proposing to save the app. So here we are now. Tell us about this potential deal to save TikTok.
Sure, yeah. I talked to two people directly involved with the White House's discussions about TikTok. They weren't allowed to speak publicly about the confidential talks, but they said software company Oracle is proposing to put up tens of billions of dollars. Microsoft is also interested in being part of this deal, and other American investors. In all, the deal would have American tech companies take majority control of TikTok's global operation, and ByteDance, TikTok's Chinese owner, would have a minority stake. Importantly, though, this deal would take control away from ByteDance when it comes to TikTok's data, algorithm, and software updates.
It sounds like this deal, though, isn't finalized. Would this current proposal be compliant with the TikTok ban law?
Yeah, White House negotiators do believe so. Remember, the TikTok law forces the app to have what's called qualified divestiture from ByteDance, and that's just a technical way of saying ByteDance or the Chinese government can't have any control and can't have any backdoors into Americans' data. People close to these talks are hopeful this will satisfy Congress, but lawmakers of both parties, you know, feel very strongly about Beijing-based ByteDance being completely walled off from TikTok, and it is a tricky proposition. I talked to Sarah Krebs. She focuses on technology and foreign policy at the Brookings Institution.
How do you prove a negative? How do you prove the absence of Chinese control of the data and the algorithm? You can audit millions of lines of code, but it's really hard to show one way or another.
Yeah, so really important to underscore here, Aisha, that in order for this deal to pass muster with Congress, showing that China has no operational control is just really going to be key here.
What more can you say about Oracle now that the company might soon own a major piece of TikTok?
Yeah, Oracle is a Austin-based software company. Its founder and chairman, Larry Ellison, is a billionaire tech mogul. He's a Republican mega donor and a huge supporter of President Trump. In Trump's first term, he tried to ban TikTok. The courts blocked it. And back then, Trump tapped Oracle to try to buy it, but didn't work out. So maybe second time's a charm. We'll see. But Ellison, you know, appeared recently next to Trump at a press conference in the Oval Office. So, you know, critics are saying it does appear as if Trump is here giving preference to a close ally. Now, I reached out to Oracle, Microsoft, and the White House for comment and have not heard back from anyone.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks.
tracking inflation, monitoring unemployment, and redistributing political power. They all rely on government statistics that experts say are facing growing threats. That's largely because of budget problems at the federal agencies that produce this data. Now, many data users are worried about potential funding cuts under the new Trump administration. NPR's Hanzi Lo Wang reports.
And supporters say federal government data is like roads and bridges, essential, but usually overlooked. And these days, the system for producing these statistics has become crumbling infrastructure.
Still doing its job, still very important, but visible cracks.
Erica Groshen was appointed during the Obama administration to lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the BLS recently proposed shrinking the number of people surveyed to produce the monthly jobs report. The Bureau of Economic Analysis has stopped releasing some data sets. And at the Census Bureau, there are questions about whether cuts are coming to next year's field test for the 2030 census. It's all tied to funding that experts say has not kept up with what the agencies need.
You're still filling the potholes on the top, but you're not repaving.
Calls to reduce the federal workforce from President Trump and Republicans in Congress have not specifically named the statistical agencies, but many advocates and officials are worried, especially when producing data is becoming more challenging.
The economy is not becoming any simpler to measure, right? Things are getting more complex.
That was Vipin Arora, director of the Bureau of Economic Analysis, speaking at a recent meeting of federal statistical officials.
I get asked about how are you going to measure AI like every week, right? And we have to think about that and we have to try different things and learn about it, right?
These statistical agencies are also dealing with a crisis facing everyone who conducts a survey or a poll. Fewer people willing to answer questions. That can mean less reliable data. These are challenges that could be overcome with new ways of using existing government records. But that takes research and testing, says William Beach, who served during the Trump and Biden administrations as the head of BLS.
The statistical system doesn't need just more money. It needs modernization, the surveys part particularly. And if we did that, over the years, we would probably spend less money on the statistical system and get a better product.
If you're really looking to cut the federal budget, you don't want to cut the things that are working. You want to cut the stuff that's not working.
Nancy Potok is a former chief statistician at the White House's Office of Management and Budget.
It's not a huge investment relative to the size of the federal government to put some money into these agencies to be able to provide that information. It's actually a wise investment.
And a choice Congress could consider ahead of the next government shutdown deadline on March 14th. Hanzi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Luis Schiavone with these headlines. Israel is blocking thousands of Palestinians from returning to their homes in northern Gaza in a dispute over the order of hostages Hamas has released after a ceasefire agreement. Speaking on Air Force One, President Trump told reporters that Arab countries, including Jordan and Egypt, should take in the refugees and build housing for them while war-ravaged Gaza is restored.
The president also says he has lifted a Biden administration hold on sending 2,000-pound bombs to Israel. And Melbourne, Yannick Sinner of Italy, has claimed his second consecutive Australian Open championship. Sinner defeated second-ranked Alexander Zverev of Germany. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Week in Addition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. This week, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will face Senate confirmation hearings in his bid to become the next Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Trump's controversial pick is expected to face tough questioning about his qualifications and track record. Many in the medical community oppose his confirmation, but there is also support from some quarters. NPR's Will Stone joins us to talk about this. Hi, Will.
Hey there.
So, Will, what are the main concerns about Kennedy's confirmation?
Well, his track record on vaccines is the most prominent one. For years, Kennedy led an advocacy group that it's a major player in the anti-vaccine movement. In 2021, he petitioned the government to revoke the authorizations for the COVID vaccines. Kennedy said in 2023 that no vaccine is safe and effective, and he's made other inaccurate claims about infectious diseases. Now, recently, Kennedy has softened his tone. After the election, he told NPR he's not going to take anyone's vaccines away. I asked Dr. Brett Giroir about this. He's a former assistant secretary for health in the first Trump administration.
Just saying, you know, I'm not going to take your vaccines away would not be sufficient for me. If that were the answer and the only explanation, I would definitely not confirm him. His issues about vaccines and reliance on quasi or pseudoscience needs to be changed.
He isn't taking a position yet, but he says senators need to ask questions because there's a lot an HHS secretary could do to undermine vaccines.
Well, where is this pushback coming from?
So many doctors are speaking out on social media and in op-eds in opposition. The biggest organized effort is a campaign that's gathered at least 15,000 signatures from physicians. That's being led by a progressive advocacy group called Committee to Protect Healthcare. Separately, the American Public Health Association has urged the Senate to reject Kennedy. But some of the most prominent physician groups, like the American Medical Association, have not weighed in publicly. I reached out to the AMA about this. They did not respond. Dr. Rob Davidson with Protect Healthcare says he's not sure why they aren't taking a stance.
It's politics, it's DC, and I guess they'll have to answer to that. I think it's wrong. I think if they truly stand for the health of our patients, they should be coming out against this and taking a stand.
But RFK Jr. has vowed to address chronic diseases like obesity and diabetes and trying to make Americans healthier again. What about that?
Well, that is a big part of his appeal. And many in public health say, you know, this is important, but this focus cannot be at the expense of preventing infectious diseases like measles. Dr. Jeffrey Flyer, a former dean of Harvard Medical School, says Kennedy has ascended to this point, not in spite of his previous activism, but because of it.
He has no other basis for being the head of HHS. Anyone could stand up and say, oh, you know, we have a lot of chronic disease. We need to look at it. The idea that he represents some new insight into the importance of that area and how we should be thinking about it is ludicrous.
And I should add that Flyer is a well-known researcher in the field of obesity.
But there are some supporters in the medical community. Who are they?
Yeah, that's right. There's also a petition from a pro-Kennedy group called MAHA Action, MAHA being short for Make America Healthy Again. And that group says it has over 4,000 verified signatures from physicians and scientists. You see a lot of support for Kennedy online in the wellness and influencer space, physicians who are focused on diet and lifestyle. One of them is Dr. Philip Ovedia, a Florida heart surgeon with a telemedicine practice.
A lot of what RFK has talked about is looking at our food supply, looking at the ingredients in our food. That's something that he's been talking about for a long time, and it's great to see that part of it being elevated.
So how likely is it that Kennedy will get confirmed?
So it's hard to say. Some Republicans have expressed concern. The former Trump official, Giroir, says it looks like there may be enough support for Kennedy to be confirmed. We reached out to a Kennedy spokesperson for comment. She said Bobby Kennedy has met with over 60 United States senators. He's prepared and excited.
That's NPR's Will Stone. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Since taking office, President Trump has threatened to levy additional sanctions and tariffs on Russia should its president, Vladimir Putin, fail to negotiate a peace in Ukraine. The existing sanctions, however, have not hurt Russia that much. From Moscow, NPR's Charles Maines looks at how the Kremlin survived the pressure and how it could still lose.
Let's acknowledge that predicting the future, much less forecasting an economy, is at its core a risky game. So when the U.S. imposed massive sanctions on Russia following its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, perhaps it's not surprising that nearly everyone, from reporters to politicians to experts, misread the moment.
Мы ошиблись.
We were wrong, all of us. Russia adapted much faster than we thought, now says Natalia Zubarevich, an economist with Moscow State University who was among those predicting doom. There was no economic collapse, no large-scale panic, obviously no end to the war. After an initial sputter, Russia's economy grew in 2023 and surged to become one of the world's fastest-growing last year. How did Russia do it? In retrospect, Zubarevich cites both a savvy Kremlin economic team and the limits of Western pressure in an increasingly diverse global economy.
Sanctions were imposed by developed countries, but Russian raw exports are bought by everyone. It turns out you can't just put a fence around one half the world. The other half will just continue trading.
Nations like China and India continue to purchase Russia's key exports, oil and gas, filling government coffers just as Moscow's energy business with much of Europe was drying up. Illicit imports from other countries, often former Soviet republics, provided an avenue for trade in otherwise banned Western goods, everything from airplane engines to the latest iPhones. Meanwhile, many Russian businesses flourished with the exit of high-profile Western companies, grabbing essentially abandoned market share.
One effect of sanctions is that there is no more fair competition, so we have like vacuum in the Russian market, and we as a company, we're happy to fill in the gaps that appeared after many foreign vendors left.
Eugenia Popova is with the Russian cybersecurity firm Positive Technologies. She says their company picked up leading industry specialists and plenty of new contracts at home and abroad, and that's after Positive Technologies was sanctioned directly by the U.S. government.
So we understood that sanctions is something which cannot stop the company from being, you know, on the market, doing the things that the company believes it should do and so on. So for us, it's like a part of our life, nothing more.
President Vladimir Putin has repeatedly argued Western sanctions are a boon to Russian industry, a sunny take on the economy that has burrowed its way into pop culture.
Господин президент.
Господин президент.
A new Russian TV comedy called Goodbye even imagines now former President Joe Biden going on an undercover trip to Russia to discover just how on earth the country keeps thriving despite Western pressure. The answer he finds out? Russians now make everything themselves. Only the real picture is proving more complicated. Take last fall, when Putin's prime minister, Mikhail Mishustin, attended the unveiling of the newest addition to Russia's long-running Volga car line, only to discover the vehicle was now entirely assembled from Chinese components. Where's the wheel from? Also China, said an exasperated Mishustin to Volga's glum-looking director. I would like, he added, for at least the wheel to be made in Russia. And 2025 sees the Russian economy facing bumpy roads in other ways, says Vladimir Inozemtsev, a Russian economist now living in the U.S.
There are now new challenges, new problems, and they cannot be treated by ordinary measures. Something is going out of control.
Defense and security will account for some 40% of all government spending this year. That's up a quarter, and an investment in guns that's so heavy it's making a mess of the proverbial butter. Prices on basic food staples, such as real butter, are up, way up. So much so, there's even been reports of supermarkets keeping it under lock and key. Inozemtsev says runaway inflation, as well as the tumbling value of Russia's currency, the ruble, and high interest rates, they're all indications that sanctions are working, just more slowly than anyone imagined.
These sanctions, they are biting the Russian economy every day. But the most important thing is the timeline. Yes, maybe in 2027, the Russian economy will dip into recession, but not now, not tomorrow.
And yet there's some problems felt today. Take my apartment building in central Moscow, where the elevator breaks down routinely, with spare parts, once from the West, now hard to find. Everyone's gotten stuck in that elevator, and now they're scared to get in, my neighbor says to the repairman, who shrugs, because he knows. Like with most problems tied to sanctions, at least so far, there's usually a way around. Charles Baines, NPR News, Moscow.
Looks like the weather in Park City, Utah calls for stars. That's right. The Sundance Film Festival is underway. A-listers, studio execs, movie lovers, they're all gathered to screen movies. Folks like us hope we can see before too long. For a little taste, Huai Chen Bui joins us from Park City. She's entertainment editor for the culture site Inverse. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It seems kind of perfect that one of the first movies that you have seen was mostly shot in Utah, even though I guess it's called Omaha?
Yeah, it's called Omaha because it's actually about the Nebraska safe haven laws in which parents can give up their infants at a hospital, fire station, without fear of prosecution. And Nebraska had a sort of loophole in their laws in which they didn't specify that the children that could be abandoned basically had to be infants, which led to many children that were not infants being abandoned. And that was something that kind of crept into the movie as it came about. It's a road trip movie with a dad and two of his kids from Utah to Omaha, Nebraska, with the turmoil over whether he should abandon his kids or not.
Oh, wow. So what else can you share about what you've seen so far?
Yeah, so I've only seen a couple other movies. I've seen Bubble and Squeak, which is a comedy from Evan Twohey that is about an American couple honeymooning in an unnamed country that has banned all cabbages, which is a big pain for them because the woman has actually smuggled 39 heads of cabbage in her pants. So it's okay. A really absurd, very silly black comedy. And I know that some people didn't quite like it as much as me, but I enjoyed this one.
What about some of the bad that you've seen? So, 'cause that sounds good. Did you see anything that's not so great?
Yes, I was really anticipating this movie called Rabbit Trap, which is this British folk horror movie starring Dev Patel. And it was a real slog that was tonally all over the place and completely confusing with what it was trying to do and whether it was trying to be a horror movie, a whimsical fairy tale movie, and was a very sad waste of Dev Patel, who I usually really enjoy.
Sundance is so much about buzz. What movies or documentaries are getting that buzz, even if you've not screened them yet?
So the movie that I've heard the most buzz out of is If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which is Mary Bronstein's surreal portrait of motherhood starring Rose Byrne. Apparently, it's a career-best performance for Rose Byrne, and it's incredible, uncomfortable watch that is just centered around this powerhouse performance. This one's getting like the most buzz out of Sundance so far. It might be the breakout film of the festival. I unfortunately missed the first screening, and the one that's coming up is at like 1 a.m., so I don't know if I'll be able to see it, but that one is one to look out for, and that's if I had legs, I'd kick you.
Do you have any, like, final bit of advice for us or recommendations for us? Like, is there one movie that you want everyone to see coming out of Sundance?
Oh, the ones that I'm looking forward to the most still are Kiss of the Spider-Woman and Opus. Those two movies are getting a lot of buzz. Opus just got a trailer released, and that stars Ayo Edebiri and John Malkovich.
That's Hwai Chen Bui, entertainment editor for the culture site Inverse. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Congress passed the Laken Riley Act, named for the Georgia nursing student murdered by a Venezuelan man who'd crossed the border illegally. The law expands the list of criminal charges that can get a migrant deported, and it may become a legal tool for President Trump's effort to carry out mass deportations. But as NPR's Martin Costi reports, that depends on the cooperation of local police and jails.
The man convicted of murdering Riley had previously been arrested in a shoplifting case in Georgia, but was let go. Now, under the Laken Riley Act, shoplifting is one of the crimes that call for deportation, along with burglary, violence that leads to injury or death, or assaulting a police officer.
Those are the people that I would love to see out of the United States.
Terry Johnson is sheriff of Alamance County in North Carolina. He supports the act because he believes the threat of deportation can deter everyday crime. He says that effect was apparent in his county almost two decades ago when deputies collaborated with federal immigration enforcement under a program known as 287G.
We've seen those individuals that were coming here for the wrong reason move out of our county to the surrounding counties. And if you looked, you would see their crime rate go up a little bit also.
But that opinion is not universal among law enforcement. Jack Donahue spent three decades with the NYPD and is now a senior fellow on policing initiatives at Rutgers University. He says police detectives especially don't want to be seen as an arm of immigration enforcement.
Listen, I'm going to put somebody in the box, or I'm going to have a complainant sitting outside in the interview room, and I'm going to talk to them. I don't want the first thing in their mind to be, are you going to deport me?
That's often cited as a reason for sanctuary city-style laws, which restrict the information that local police and jails can share with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. But Donahue says those restrictions are not absolute, especially when it comes to tracking organized crime groups.
There's a reason why police agencies across the country are able to solve crimes and to learn what's happening and how those crews are working. It's because people are actually sharing information. We don't want to shut that down.
Some police say that kind of cooperation could be shut down by the Laken Riley Act's mandate that people be deported for lesser crimes. They say it could make it harder for prosecutors to cut deals with people who could implicate worse criminals, especially because the act calls for deporting people who are merely charged with crimes, not convicted. But the reality is, if the Trump administration is going to ramp up deportations, current ICE staffers may not be up to the task.
The job of an immigration officer has changed fairly considerably in the last decade. It's much more of a desk job now.
Austin Coker studies immigration enforcement at Syracuse University. He says ICE's internal enforcement officers focus on watching arrest records and other data to find the people they want to detain, and then they often rely on cops to do their legwork.
When ICE has been able to be most effective, you know, during the Obama administration, for instance, it's been because they have leveraged the resources of local agencies. So partnering up with local sheriffs and local police departments because, you know, ICE just isn't able to do it themselves.
Traditionally, those partnerships were voluntary. The feds didn't have the power to force local police to help them. But the Trump administration is turning up the heat. This week, the new leadership at the Justice Department circulated a memo promising to investigate and potentially prosecute local officials who, quote, threaten to impede immigration enforcement. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It was one of then candidate Trump's most popular campaign promises.
When I get to office, we are going to not charge taxes on tips, people making tips.
What if taxes on tips come to an end? Economists offer their takes Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. The forecast is rain in Southern California, and it's a welcome assist to firefighters battling lingering blazes in Los Angeles County. However, local officials are keeping an eye on the threat of downpours and potential resulting mudslides in fire-scarred areas. In South Korea, prosecutors have indicted impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol on charges of rebellion in connection with his turmoil-creating martial law decree. Yoon remains jailed and faces a trial expected to last up to 6 months. President Trump has changed the name of Alaska's Denali back to Mount McKinley. It's a nod to President William McKinley. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester, with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. You might think you know who makes up the largest group of caregivers in this country. Nurses, nursing home aides. No, if we're talking about older adults, it's unpaid caregivers, and it's often women. The government estimates that there are about 53 million such caregivers, and even though it can be a full-time and physically and emotionally difficult, it's typically not recognized as a job. We are joined by two people who do this work. Don Shedrick is a social worker who is a caregiver to her mother. Also with us is reporter Kat McGowan. Let me start with you, Kat. You're a science and health reporter, but a few years ago, you began to focus on caregivers. What made you want to look at caregiving?
Yeah, thank you. I've been a journalist for decades, and then caregiving happened to me, first with my sister-in-law and then my two parents. And I realized, looking around, there was very little conversation about adult caregiving. People are living longer with more chronic diseases, and more care is coming out of the hospital and into the home. So caregivers are asked to do things that a generation ago only nurses would have done. All unpaid, mostly untrained. I think it's like our largest unpaid healthcare workforce.
Well, Don, can you share your experience caring for your mother?
Sure. My mom has a progressive form of multiple sclerosis. By the time I was finishing college in 1996, that was around the time that she started to require the use of a cane. And it has been quite the journey as her MS has advanced to the point where now she hasn't walked unassisted since 2004. She pretty much needs assistance with all of her activities of daily living at this point.
How do you juggle making a living and caregiving with your mom who needs so much support?
Yeah, juggling is the right word because that's often what it feels like. I'm grateful that I do get to work for myself. And so even though I have control over my schedule and the work that I do and the work that I take on as a consultant and trainer, what a lot of people who have not been a caregiver don't realize is that it literally is a job. There are very specific requirements, you know, in terms of providing physical support. There are many caregivers who are also providing administrative, you know, taking responsibility for managing medical appointments or interacting with healthcare providers.
Yeah, you would not believe how many people I hear, like, what really is so draining for people often is the paperwork, you know, dealing with insurance companies, dealing with medical systems, like trying to get benefits organized, you know, and that's not rewarding. Whereas if you're helping your mom have breakfast, that is rewarding.
Well, Kat, can you talk about that toll, that emotional toll, even with families when they take it on? A group of siblings may not know what they're signing up for when they're, you know, trying to care for their aging parent.
I'm a caregiving reporter, so I'm talking to caregivers all the time. And so many of them say, you know, it's not that they don't want to do it. They want to do the job. They just want to do it with training and help and support. There's no system. There's no one place to turn or like obvious place to learn how to do what you're doing. And a lot of times, you know, family dynamics are really difficult. And, you know, again, a lot of the people I speak to, their family's not there for them. They're taking it on pretty much on their own. And they find themselves doing all the work and solving all the problems by themselves. And that's part of the reason why the loneliness becomes so intense. We just need to be talking about this more so that it's recognized, so that it's validated, and there's an understanding of how many people are doing this and how hard it can be, and also very rewarding and filled with love at the same time.
Don, when did you know that you needed more help?
Ooh, it was at least 10 years into the journey for me, because that was around the time that I started to feel the emotional impact that it was having on me, and also the physical and social, you know, the way that it was just impacting my life. I just came to, you know, the realization like, wow, like I need some help here. And so at that time, I was grateful to have found a therapist who specialized in working with caregivers, because she herself at that time was a former caregiver. She had cared for her mother who had Alzheimer's. But it took me 10 years to get there, because I just was coming home to help my mom. I didn't even identify as a caregiver. I wasn't conscious to like a caregiver identity until I realized that I needed some support if I was going to be able to continue to do this.
What are some of those resources that people can turn to that could help provide support for caregivers?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's no system, which is difficult. There's no one place to look. You have to research it out yourself. A lot of people find a lot of help in support groups, not just for emotional support, but just practical support, because, you know, I myself belong to a couple support groups for helping people with dementia. And any problem that you're dealing with, somebody's dealt with it before. So that, like, just person to person is really valuable. And the VA actually does caregiver support, but it's hard. You kind of have to research it and patch it together depending on your circumstances and who the person is you're helping and where you are in life.
This is a question to you both. What do you wish the rest of us who are not caregivers knew about what it's like to be a caregiver?
Yeah, folks really need to understand that when we consider our cultural and social, you know, moment that we are in, that if you have not been a caregiver, or if you're not currently a caregiver, you will most likely be a caregiver at some point in the future, if you also may not require care. So just let the caregivers in your life know that you see them. Authentically offer support and help in the ways that you know that you can, so that we can keep this conversation going and more caregivers, you know, feel comfortable expressing themselves and their experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what Dawn said. I think sometimes people are afraid of the topic, especially when it comes to elders. But, if we talked about caregiving as much as we talk about parenting, for example, you know, where it was just like, oh yeah, this is happening, I've got a toddler, you know, if that was as normal to say, oh yeah, my mom's got dementia, you know, I think it would be a lot easier, even if nothing else changed.
Kat McGowan reports on caregiving and is a Rosalind Carter Mental Health Journalism Fellow. Dawn Shedrick is a social worker and caregiver for her mother. You can check out our series on caregiving by going to npr.org/caregiving. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's no cure-all for when life's got you down. But for Charles Wig Walker, singing from the soul can help paint the blues better.
I think these songs will do that because when I listen to them now, it does lift me up. And now the sun is starting to shine, and I
know that everything will be all right. The 84-year-old soul singer knows a lot about that. He's been performing since the 1950s, connecting with audiences from New York to his hometown of Nashville. His new album, This Love Is Gonna Last, is a testament to the timelessness of love and soul music. So for those who are not super familiar with the soul scene, you've been performing for decades as the lead of the J.C. Davis Band and later Little Charles and the Sidewinders. Where did this passion for performing come from?
Well, I started singing around in the church when I was a little kid and just singing everywhere I could possibly sing. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things.
You're 84 now, 84 years young.
Yep.
You've spent most of your life performing. Was there like a moment in your career where you felt like you had really made it? You felt like things were really coming your way? Like, is there a particular moment that stands out to you?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, I've been in this business for a long, long time. And like Charles, the producer and writer, he and I wrote most of the stuff.
That's Charles Treadway. That's the producer and co-writer on much of the album.
Yes, that's him. And I don't know what part of my life and when it happened, but a lot of these songs are about me and my wife that she just passed away. Mm. But these songs were written with her in mind, you know.
I'm so sorry for the passing of your wife. As you said, I know that a lot of this album is made with her in mind. There you were, such a special thing. Told me I should give love one more try. I'm so glad, girl, you blew my mind. I know this love. The song, This Love Is Gonna Last. It's a beautiful song and a beautiful sentiment about your wife.
Yeah.
Why do you think love is such a universal thing for soul music? You know, why do you think after all these years, there's still more songs to sing about falling in love and being in love?
To sing these songs now, I mean, especially soul music, it's all about things that you go through. Mm-hmm. Things that you remember in your life. Mm-hmm. And you just jot it down and you start trying to get a song together on it, you know. I prefer talking about real things that happened to me, how I feel.
What do you think about, like, because obviously there's still soul music around, but it has changed a lot. What do you think about music that's out now?
Singers like me and people like that, it's a lot of feelings from things that happened to you in your life. Mm-hmm. And some of these young guys is singing now, they ain't had those kind of problems. Mm-hmm. I can't knock the music of today. I just do a different style of music. I've got something I wanna say. You touch
So I love soul music, and I feel like, you know, people, especially soul singers back in the day, they would be more vulnerable, and they would also beg a lot more, and I like that, you know, and they'd be sorry.
Yeah, you got
like
that right.
They don't do that on songs anymore.
That's the reason why I kind of stick to my style of singing. It does all right for me, you know. Yeah. I'm not trying to change with the times. I just kind of stick to what I know best.
You've performed alongside, you know, legendary people like James Brown, Etta James, Otis Redding, yep, and Sam Cooke. Is there anything you learned from them that you still bring to your own performances?
Yes, quite a lot. I learned a lot when I went to New York and got with James Brown. He was at the Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
I was out there to learn what I could learn about putting on a show.
Mm-hmm.
It helped me a lot because I was doing well around Nashville, mm-hmm, as a young kid, but I knew it was more than that.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite person to work with?
Yeah, I enjoyed working with James. I enjoyed, mm-hmm, working with Jackie Wilson mainly because he was more of my style, mm-hmm, of a performer. I used to do a lot of that dancing around and jumping around, turning flips and all that.
Oh, wow. Now, do you still do any of that?
I certainly do not.
Well, we have a clip of Serendipity, another, mm-hmm, song about falling in love. Women wild, because you know that these soul singers used to drive the women wild.
Yeah, you can say that. I had big crowds all the time.
yeah. This is your first album in over a decade. What made you want to come back now?
Well, I still was singing around, playing a lot of clubs around Nashville. So I've been steady working.
Mm-hmm.
I do my style of singing, and that's what matters to me.
And do you want to keep making albums? Because you're 84 now. I mean,
as long as I can make it to the studio.
Okay, you want to keep going. So you don't want to slow down. You don't want to just take, you know, retire. That you don't want to do that.
No, I don't want to do that. I want to sing my way out of here.
That's Charles Wig Walker. His new album, This Love Is Gonna Last, is out now. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much. And if I have to give it a name, I'll say,
this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Have a wonderful week.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. This is NPR.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.